The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Thanks to Grammarly for supporting the Lawfare podcast. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. Start writing confidently by going to grammarly.com/lawfare to get 20% off a Grammarly premium account today.
It's not a vote on a particular witness. It is a vote that will be taken on sort of whether to consider calling any additional witnesses or subpoenaing documents. So that actually is the very first vote that senators will take. If that vote is, you know, successful in the sense of, yes, senators want to hear from additional witnesses or subpoena documents, then there would be, in theory, additional votes on these things. There's this more general vote first.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 28th, 2020. We got an impeachment trial going on, people, in case you hadn't noticed. We've had hours and hours, like 21 hours of presentation by the House managers. We've had 10 or 11 hours so far of presentation by the president's defense team. Senators are drinking milk. They are sitting in their seats and playing with little fidget toys. They're also sneaking out to hang in the cloakroom because it's pretty long, people. But it's also super substantive. It's got a lot going on. So to bring us up to speed where we are after the big John Bolton bombshell revelation over the weekend and the coming fight over witnesses, in the Jungle Studio, I have Margaret Taylor and Quinta Jurassic. And joining us by the magic of telephonic communications from Tennessee is Jonathan David Schaub, who is joining the faculty of the University of Kentucky. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 501, an impeachment trial update. Margaret, get us started here. For those who have not been following our daily The Report podcast feed, the impeachment, what is the state of play right now? Where are we today on Tuesday, as we're recording in the morning in the impeachment trial?
So it was exactly one week ago, Tuesday, that the actual sort of arguments on the resolution to organize the sort of rules of the road for the trial began. That lasted a day, late into the night. Over the next 3 days, the House managers presented their case, all the facts and their legal argumentation. They took the full 24 hours over 3 days as provided for in the organizing resolution for the trial. Then they wrapped up. And then next up was the president's defense counsel. And this today, Tuesday, is their third day of presentations. They presented for about 2 hours on Saturday, about 10 hours or so, or 8 hours yesterday. And then they're going to wrap it up today. And just to look ahead a little bit to what's to come, the next phase in the trial is up to 16 hours of senators posing written questions to either the House managers or the president's defense team. So that's what's coming up next.
And do we imagine that the president's team is going to use their full additional 8 hours today? And how much of the 16 hours do you think we are likely to see used rather than waived so we can get to some actual decisions?
So I've heard that the president's defense team will actually wrap up pretty quickly, probably in about a couple of hours. And by the time this podcast goes up, we'll know if that's true or not. In terms of the 16 hours, I haven't heard a whole lot on that. I suspect that it will be largely taken up. The time will be largely taken because senators will want to give the respective parties almost a chance at kind of a rebuttal of each other's arguments. So I expect a large number of questions from senators and that the bulk of those 16 hours will be taken up. That's what I expect.
All right. Key question, Margaret. If you were a member of the president's legal team, having now watched them all and granted, you can't claim Pam Bondi because I am Pam Bondi. Which member of the president's legal team are you?
Oh, okay. I think I'm not like super proud of this, but I'm pretty sure I'm Patrick Philbin because, you know, he is the guy who's up there. He's just presenting the facts, you know, just the facts, ma'am. He's up there. He's just point by point by point. Not a lot of color, not a lot of humor, but he's getting the job done. So, you know, that's who I think I am.
And which House impeachment manager are you?
Well, I think now I'm going to speak aspirationally. I love Val Demings. I think she's just such a rock star. So that's who I aspire to be, Val Demings,
so
on the House manager's team.
We have just learned so much about your personality. Margaret Taylor is some combination of Val Demings and Pat Philbin. Okay, Quinta, the bombshell over the weekend, John Bolton, our kind of Godot of this whole process. The conventional wisdom yesterday was that the revelations about Bolton had shifted the momentum. We were on a kind of glide path to the Senate voting more or less in party lines, except for, you know, maybe Romney and Collins not to hear from witnesses. And now people have gone, oh, my God, maybe we have to hear from some witnesses after all. First of all, do you think the conventional wisdom is right and that's the direction that it's going? And how do you sort of game out the next phase at this point?
I think it's worth going over just what the bombshell was. So John Bolton has been the kind of eminence grace at the back of this impeachment hearing, looming over everything. But we haven't heard his testimony, of course, and yet he has a book coming out. It currently has a release date of March 17th. So the New York Times has had a string of stories, actually, based on reports of what the unpublished manuscript contains. Essentially, it seems that Bolton had reports that he had a conversation with Trump in which Trump explicitly told him that he wanted to keep the hold on aid to Ukraine unless the Ukrainians announced the investigations he wanted, and later that Bolton also wrote that he was concerned about Trump's relationships with authoritarian leaders. That first story is really important because it fills in a hole in the evidence that Trump's lawyers have been making a great deal out of, which is it provides a direct link between the president and the withholding of the aid. Granted, the evidence has been quite strong that Trump was involved in that withholding, but this is really sort of firsthand information. So then now the question is, as you say, will the Republican senators, knowing this, try to keep things speeding along to an acquittal? Or has this changed the calculus such that we might actually hear from Bolton? I'm not sure. It does seem that there is really a struggle going on in the Republican caucus in the Senate right now over how to handle this. Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski both gave sort of weird mealy-mouthed statements yesterday saying, you know, we've said we might vote for witnesses and we sure are thinking about it. Mitt Romney implied he might vote to hear from Bolton as well. And Lindsey Graham this morning suggested that the Senate should be able to read the book manuscript in a classified setting, but not hear from Bolton. That proposal is kind of ridiculous because the book isn't classified and everyone else will be able to read it in March. But I do think the fact that Graham is kind of throwing that out there suggests that the Republicans are really trying to figure out how to get around this obstacle. And that may mean voting to hear Bolton as a witness.
All right. Quinta, if you were a House impeachment manager, who were you?
Well, I will say I'm also a fan of Val Demings. I'm not going to put on airs, but I have been very impressed with Adam Schiff's performance without saying that I would be Schiff. He's done a really good job throughout this entire process, kind of telling the story and bringing it all together, even despite the howls of rage by some Republicans at some of the points he's been making about Trump's less savory tendencies. So I think it's worth giving him a hand.
And without – you're not allowed to claim Pam Bondi because that's me or Pat Philbin because Margaret has dibs on Philbin. Which member of the president's defense team are you?
If I had to pick – I would go with Jane Raskin, who gave a somewhat bizarre presentation about why Rudy Giuliani is just the swellest guy you'll ever meet. Not because of the content of the presentation, which was ridiculous, but because she at least didn't sound like a crazy person while giving it, you know, which I think given the low bar that we're dealing with is kind of the best you could ask for.
All right. So we get by one means or another, the Senate issues a subpoena to John Bolton, who says he would comply with it. But the White House is making some noises about preventing his testimony on national security grounds or on executive privilege grounds. And there is an idea going around, particularly on Fox News, that they could get an injunction to prevent his testimony. Jonathan, walk us through it. If John Bolton is willing to testify and the Senate is willing to call him, how much latitude does the White House actually have to stop him?
Well, I think you have to divide it into, I guess, two separate questions. One is could they actually stop him? And I think the answer to that is no. But the second question is, could they make it difficult and try to delay it? And would, if they did, would Bolton sort of, you know, say, I'm going to wait until this plays out? And the answer to that is probably yes. And that would be by trying to file some kind of suit. In the late 70s, a similar kind of suit, obviously not in the impeachment context, but the Department of Justice sued AT&T, who was about to turn over information to Congress, and the Congress intervened, and the executive branch said, you know, President Ford has asserted privilege over these documents, and AT&T can't give them to Congress, and it wanted the courts to sort of adjudicate that claim of privilege. And the courts were very hesitant to and said, no, you guys work it out. But that case was national security letters, there was a confidentiality clause, and the Department of Justice in the McGahn litigation and really since the 80s consistently has said, you know, courts cannot decide these disputes. These stay out of the courts. These should be resolved between the executive branch and Congress. And so they could file a suit and say, we need to protect the president's privilege, and there are we can talk about there are other many other problems with that kind of suit, including potential waiver, since Bolton seems to have shared this book with publishers and many other people. But I mean, they could file the suit and make the argument, and if they did that, Bolton may say, well, I'm going to wait and see what happens in the suit. And then of course you've got to have some kind of filings and proceedings and maybe an appeal, and I think that's really what they're waiving right now, is saying, hey, we're going to make this difficult and delay things and keep all of you senators here at trial for quite some time while we figure out, you know, all these legal proceedings get resolved.
Yeah, so that seems like a double-edged sword from the White House's point of view, because the longer it goes, the longer people's attention is on Bolton and the rather unpleasant things that he is likely to say. And presumably the more of the book will dribble out. And so I guess my question is it really in the White House's interest, if they have no prospect of prevailing, to have an extended litigation that the major purpose of which is to delay the inevitable?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think that if push comes to shove and there are enough votes to subpoena Bolton, that there will not be a suit filed. I mean, they would have to go against sort of longstanding positions of the Justice Department about the justiciability of those suits. There would be First Amendment concerns, waiver concerns. I mean, the prospect of success, I think, is minuscule. And they have to find lawyers who are willing to file it. But at the same time, they can kind of waive that now to keep senators from voting yes. And I think that's the gambit, is to say, if you vote yes, we're going to file a suit and we're going to make this really difficult and there's going to be other witnesses and this is all going to take forever. And so their goal is to get them to vote no against witnesses. And if there is actually a yes vote, I think you're right. I don't think it's in their interest to delay it and to actually file the suit, but that doesn't keep them from threatening to do it.
I just want to make one point, which is that under the organizing resolution that was passed on a party line vote, there is sort of an initial vote, and Jonathan, you referenced it. It's not a vote on a particular witness. It is a vote that will be taken on sort of whether to consider calling any additional witnesses or subpoenaing documents. So that actually is the very first vote that senators will take. If that vote is, you know, successful in the sense of, yes, senators want to hear from additional witnesses or subpoena documents, then there would be, in theory, additional votes on these things. So I just wanted to point that out. There's this more general vote first. Then if that's, you know, successful, these more specific votes on individuals.
Yeah, it's a good point. I just want to add to it that all of this is in flat violation of the Senate standing rules on impeachment trials, which start with the presumption that both sides in the trial will call their witnesses rather than that you will have threshold votes on whether to allow those rules to go into effect. But that's neither here nor there. Unlike the president's defenders, I don't pretend that the Senate is actually bound by its rules the way the formalists who are defending the president contend the House is bound by their understanding of its rules. Jonathan, if you were a House impeachment manager, who would you be?
I think I would be the guy that was staying up late a few weekends ago writing the brief, and you know, whatever staff attorneys in Adam Schiff's office were putting the briefs together. That's kind of where I feel comfortable
behind the scenes guy.
Well played, sir. And if you were a member of the president's defense team, I take it you're not going to play the Alan Dershowitz card.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, it would be nice to kind of stand up and just give a speech and just talk. And I can see myself doing that. But you guys have taken Philbin, who I think would be who I would most likely choose. But
this is why you and I get along so well, Jonathan.
All right, let's think through Margaret's excellent point about the actual procedural posture here. We're going to have this threshold vote on witnesses in general, and then we're going to have a knockdown, drag-out fight over which ones to call. Margaret, what do we know about how that process works? How granular can we be about what the actual rules here are between the standing rules and the resolution? And is there any reason to think that what will actually happen is not that they'll figure out what the forces, who the median vote is, and they'll pass some kind of new resolution reflecting how they can get to 51 now, that they'll, will they just follow the roadmap that has been laid out, or will they lay out a new roadmap to reflect the new constellation of power, whatever it is?
It's a good question. The organizing resolution does give us a little bit of granularity. So essentially, at the end of the 16 hours of questioning written questions by the senators, there will be 4 hours of argument by the parties. So the parties being the House managers on the one side, the president's defense counsel on the other, equally divided, followed by deliberation by the Senate. And what that word deliberation means is that it very well may be the case that the senators go into closed session. So we, the public, may not see that deliberation unless there's a vote to open it up, which there probably won't be, or it won't succeed. Okay, so if so ordered under the impeachment rules on the question of whether it shall be an order to consider and debate under the impeachment rules any motion to subpoena witnesses or documents. So that's this more general first vote that we were talking about earlier. And then the rules say the Senate, so there's debate, 4 hours of debate. The Senate, without any intervening action, motion, or amendment, shall then decide by the yeas and nays whether it shall be in order to consider and debate under the impeachment rules any motion to subpoena witnesses or documents. Following the disposition of that question, other motions provided under the impeachment rules shall be in order. So the resolution does give us an idea of what's going to happen. The thing to keep in mind, though, which you alluded to, is it's always the case that senators can sort of get together, maybe in their closed deliberative process, they can kind of get together, figure out a new plan, a new deal for how to move forward. So say, for example, there is some kind of agreement in their deliberations about the need to call a witness. They could, it would be within their powers, and they could essentially have another vote, maybe to revise this resolution, to have a shared path forward. So that's kind of what I'm looking for going forward in terms of how this really rolls out.
Thanks to Grammarly for supporting our podcast. Grammarly is a communication tool that helps people improve their writing to be mistake-free, clear, and effective. It makes you look and sound smarter, whether at school, at work, or when you're on the go, or when you're writing tweets about the Lawfare podcast, as I will do when this episode gets released. So Grammarly's free version for your computer or your phone helps review critical spelling and grammar, while the premium service looks at advanced punctuation, style, vocabulary, conciseness, tone, and readability for things like resumes or blog posts or, you know, the show notes of the Lawfare podcast, that kind of stuff. So, all right, I want to confess that I was pretty skeptical of Grammarly. And Jacob Schultz, who is the audio engineer for this episode of the podcast, when Grammarly approached us about doing an ad buy, was super excited about it because he says he uses Grammarly all the time. And I thought Jacob was kind of new. And so, you know, like, all right, you know, maybe he doesn't know how to write yet. And so he's relying on this tool. And I got to say, he was right. I was wrong. I've been using Grammarly at his instruction for the past few weeks. And I've found it surprisingly helpful in catching mistakes that I know I would have missed otherwise, because I was doing more or less the same thing before and I wasn't catching them. So it makes good vocabulary suggestions to make sure I'm not, you know, relying on the same word. I tend to use the word boom in my tweets and, you know, a lot. It makes suggestions, you know. It's not one size fits all. It lets you personalize your experience for whatever you're trying to do. So look, I mean, Jacob just gets points on this one. So go to Grammarly, like Jacob, grammarly.com/lawfare to get 20% off your Grammarly premium account today. That's grammarly.com/lawfare for 20% off your Grammarly premium account. Okay, Quinta. Bolton for Hunter Biden. Is that the compromise?
I've seen a lot of outrage about that suggestion. I think the reasoning being that it seeds ground on the House's part in sort of acknowledging that, you know, bringing Hunter Biden in as a legitimate part of the discussion. I gotta say, I'm not viscerally opposed to the idea. I do think that having Bolton there testifying to whatever it is he has to say, which so far is really damaging. And having him there under oath is a valuable thing to do. And it's not obvious to me that the cost of having Hunter Biden there outweighs that. That said, I suppose you could argue that you're sort of giving the president fodder for Fox News, essentially. On the other hand, they'll do that anyway. So in my mind, the jury is kind of out. I do think it is interesting to note that Rudy Giuliani apparently has been texting reporters saying that wanting to know why the Democrats want to call Bolton but not him. So, you know, we may have Rudy Giuliani, you know, busting down the Senate door and demanding to testify.
Okay, I want to – I don't know – I want to throw this out because I actually think the Bolton for Hunter Biden trade would be a huge win for the president, right? The president wants this trial to be about Hunter Biden as much as possible and wants it to be – the whole purpose of this escapade was to shift the focus of things onto Biden's and corruption in a fashion that would damage the Biden campaign. And so my instinct is, unless it is clearly relevant to the trial, that would be almost like a gratuity to Trump. It would be doing the thing in the Senate that he was trying to get Ukraine to do. So all of which raises the question, under a reasonable conception of relevance, could the president's lawyers, Jonathan, make an argument that if you're trying to assess the reasonableness of the president's belief and his actions with respect to Ukrainian President Zelensky, knowing what Hunter Biden was actually up to in Ukraine and with Burisma is relevant to that assessment? Or is that, well, it doesn't actually matter what Biden was actually up to in Ukraine. It only matters what the president knew. So if we evaluated the relevance question in a normal trial setting, what do you think? Do the president's lawyers get to call Hunter Biden?
Yeah, I mean, I am certainly no expert on evidence, but I think, you know, generally courts, and if we're talking about a, you know, like a court proceeding, they adopt a pretty, you know, generous conception of relevance. And the inquiry is often, you know, does this advance in any way the information that has some connection to what's being alleged and what's being talked about? And particularly when it's the defendant, I think usually given more license to present sort of whatever they think is in their interest and their defense, unless it is, you know, prejudicial or sort of barred by another rule of evidence. Generally, the default is, if it's at all relevant, let's let the jury hear it, and the sides can kind of argue about what it should mean. I think it's pretty clearly, when you're talking about what the president knew and whether what he did was a high crime or misdemeanor that warrants removal, Hunter Biden is completely irrelevant.
All right, Margaret, what do you think? Is a trade here justifiable under any reasonable trial procedure, or is it just, you know, sort of legislative horse trading of the ugliest sort?
I really do view it as more like horse trading, you know, which is something that is done on Capitol Hill, and this is a political setting. But yeah, I really do view it that way. I would also just point out that in the organizing resolution, it provides for, you know, if witnesses are called, they are first deposed, which means it would not be public. The House managers on the one hand, the President's Defense Counsel on the other hand, would be deposing Hunter Biden or Bolton or whoever in private first. And then it is the Senate decides what witnesses will be heard in open testimony. So just a little wrinkle, they may hear more and know more than the general public does about kind of what these people are saying, how they come off in a trial. So we may not see all of that. It may be kind of a more finished product that we see.
Right. And that is, in fact, what happened during the Clinton trial when, if memory serves, I think there was a actually rather similar debate over whether to hear from witnesses in that trial, though it was a bit different because there was, after all, a fully developed record, whereas here there are genuinely contested matters of fact and there are also witnesses who have never been heard from. That was not the case in the Clinton trial. There was a complete record from the Starr report. On the other hand, the House managers, then Republicans, wanted to hear from some of the principal witnesses, and Democrats wanted not to. And as I recall, they ended up hearing only by video deposition from three or four witnesses, including most famously Monica Lewinsky, and then played snippets of those video depositions in the Senate in lieu of kind of live Senate testimony by these people. So Quinta, is that a decent outcome here? Do you need John Bolton and his mustache to show up in the flesh, or would you be satisfied with video questions to the man and his facial hair?
Well, of course I would be disappointed, you know, not to get an up close and personal look at John Bolton's mustache. But I think the Clinton precedent is really apropos here. I just finished reading Peter Baker's book on the Clinton impeachment, The Breach. And one of the interesting sections is on the Lewinsky deposition and how it was clips were played in the Senate trial. And Lewinsky really got the better of her questioners during the deposition itself, and the way Baker writes it, that very much came through, even in the sort of selections that were clipped for the trial. So I think that's a good demonstration that you don't necessarily need the witness to be there in person to get the sort of spark and energy of having that testimony. And we've seen the House managers use clips of testimony from witnesses before the House Intelligence Committee during the impeachment inquiry, I think to great effect during their presentation of the evidence against the president. So while it may not be ideal for the House managers, it strikes me as a potentially reasonable compromise, though I have no idea if senators will end up going down that path.
All right. So, Jonathan, we end up in a situation where we call Bolton. I think probably we're leaning in that direction. Is that the extent of it? Schumer asked for four witnesses. In a normal trial, the House managers would get to call whoever they wanted who was relevant to their case. Presumably, the Senate is not going to tolerate that. So how does this end up getting limited? Is it basically McConnell and the Republican majority decide, okay, we'll give you Bolton and maybe take the Biden testimony in reciprocal response? Or is it kind of you do one witness and see where that leads and then decide whether to do more?
Yeah, I think it's probably the latter. There is a difference between Bolton and the other, at least of the four that Schumer had identified, Mulvaney and Robert Blair, who is an aide to Mulvaney, and Michael Duffy, who's an OMB official who was involved in the emails about putting the hold on the aide. All of those individuals are current officials, and they were directed not to comply with subpoenas in the House, and they complied with those directives. And none of them has come out, as Bolton did, who's, of course, a former official, but none of them have come out and said, you know, we will testify if we're called, if we receive a subpoena. So there are additional issues there that might make the House manager sort of wary of starting out with all of them at once. But if Bolton, of course, might have all the information that they really need, depending on what he would say. So they might start with Bolton, see if there's a court fight or a privilege fight. And if there's going to be, maybe they try to get the other witnesses involved in that as well, so they can kind of wrap it all up at once in terms of if there is litigation over privilege. But if there's not with Bolton, they might think, you know, we've got this and this is enough, and we don't want to, you know, sort of go down another messy road with these current officials.
Yeah. And just to, you know, we gamed out how a fight over if the White House tried to stop Bolton from testifying, how that would play out. how is it different with respect to sitting officials who are willing to follow the president's directive if the Senate subpoenas them and the, you know, and they decide to honor a presidential order not to testify? How is that procedurally different from the White House trying to stop Bolton, who is willing to testify?
Yeah, so with Bolton, the onus will really be on the White House and the Department of Justice if they're gonna have to stop him. So they're gonna have to file a suit, get a court order, or at least get him to agree to wait until the court resolves it. And they have, you know, they need to make it stop him, or he's gonna testify. With the other officials, if they are willing to just abide by, you know, a letter, an OLC opinion saying you don't have to appear, then the onus is on the Senate, and they're going to have to take additional votes and keep that sort of coalition together. Because if they follow what they did in the House, then they will say, we are with Mulvaney and Blair, they'll say, these individuals are our senior presidential advisors who are immune from showing up, so they don't even have to appear. And the Senate subpoena is sort of null and void. And to get them to show up, the Senate would have to, you know, sue, or, you know, the sort of extreme scenario that has been floated is sending a sergeant at arms to go get them and bring them into the Senate physically, which seems unlikely to happen. But it's a would create more difficulties and would require keeping, you know, whatever coalition formed to call those individuals to testify. All of them would have to be on board for all of these actions, whether it's holding those individuals in contempt. So they would have a number of options, but it would require a number of votes and sort of maintaining that coalition. And that seems like it might be difficult given what we've seen so far.
All right. That brings us to the legislative coalition that would have to be created and hold together in order to do these things. So, Margaret, if we had an Americanist political scientist here, say Molly Reynolds,
I miss her.
Yeah, she'll be back. But if Molly were here, she would say, okay, you find the marginal vote, the median voter vote in the chamber, and that person really has the power, right? And so in this case, the median group of voters are Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, and let's just say Lamar Alexander for fun, right? If that group can get together and can lay down the law and say, this is what we will vote for these things and we will not vote for these things, that will define what the chamber does. So if you are, say, a senior staffer to those people or those people themselves, why aren't they just getting together and saying, let's have a unified position and we can direct the entire direction this trial goes?
So in theory, your theory is right. I think there is a practical issue here, though, which is the incredible amount of control that Mitch McConnell has had over his caucus. And he's showed that throughout this trial. He's showed that throughout the time he's been majority leader. So that's one factor. You also have the president out there. And this was sort of part of these proceedings about, you know, Adam Schiff saying that somebody in the president's sphere was saying, well, if any senators go against the president, their head will be on a pike. And that caused a big, you know, hullabaloo. So that it's not a vacuum that they're making these decisions in. And Mitch McConnell, you know, I got to say, I was thinking about this the other day. I love the movie The Hunt for Red October. And in that movie, Fred Thompson, who is a former senator, and also I think took some part in the Nixon impeachment proceedings.
Yeah, he was minority counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee. He worked for Howard Baker.
Right. And so in the movie, Hunt for Red October, as he plays Admiral Painter, and there's a scene on the aircraft carrier where Admiral Painter, Fred Thompson, says to the Jack Ryan character, you know, the Russians don't take a dump, son, without a plan. And to me, that is how Mitch McConnell runs the Senate. He always has a plan. And so even if those four senators were very independent-minded, I mean, they'd have to have a really, really strong will to do something that is inconsistent with what McConnell wants to do. And McConnell has made it very clear he will try to do things consistent with what the president wants to do. So it's a high bar in my view.
Key question. When you came over to Lawfare from the Senate, did you imagine yourself quoting that line on a podcast distributed to tens of thousands of people?
It was my greatest dream.
Okay, good. Just checking. Yeah, let's talk about Mitch McConnell's plan. So Mitch McConnell had a plan, and it was blown up by John Bolton over the weekend. Somebody, I think, I don't remember who tweeted. Oh, it was Julian Sanchez of the Cato Institute tweeted, and we would have done it too if it weren't for those kids. You know, so
Scooby-Doo.
Plan A blown up. What is Mitch McConnell's plan B?
So I think I'm going to go back to the resolution, which again provides for this much more general vote about whether to call witnesses and subpoena documents at all. So if I'm Mitch McConnell, I say, okay, you group, whichever group of Romney and Collins and Murkowski, you guys can vote, you know, no, or vote yes, or whatever, vote to call, you know, have this general vote to call new witnesses. But the vote is still going to fail. So they give those senators, Mitch McConnell gives those senators a little bit of leeway to sort of vote with Democrats on this one thing, but the net effect is still to shut down this idea of witnesses and new documentation. I think that could very be what he's still going for.
So you think he's still going for we never hear from John Bolton?
I think, yes, I think that is what he's still going for. I think he wants to shut this down quickly.
And how does that work if you're a Republican senator and you vote with Mitch McConnell to shut things down, knowing that John Bolton's book with what the New York Times describes as dozens of pages is coming out a month and a half from now? That's a heavy lift of an ask for senators who were running this year.
That's true, but I still think that it's possible that all of this sort of doesn't matter around election time. And the base Trump voter isn't following this in all of this detail and isn't going to have their mind changed, in my opinion, by someone like John Bolton coming and testifying.
But that doesn't help you if you're Cory Gardner, right? It doesn't help you if you're Susan Collins. You're not going to get reelected by the base Trump voter. You actually need the marginal voter in states that are going to vote for, you know, Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg or Elizabeth Warren.
But that's the thing. Mitch McConnell would choose those vulnerable Senate Republicans who are in their election year and say, you can vote with Democrats. That way, those people get to go home and say, well, I voted to open up to witnesses so we could get Bolton. But like, you know, we lost the vote, but I voted to do it, but we lost. Sorry. So that's sort of the bargain I would think that McConnell might still be looking for here.
Just one follow up. You know, I think what McConnell seems to do so well is also kind of adjust on the fly if his original plan gets altered. And we saw that with some of the plan about the schedule is going to be, you know, 2 days and 12 hours a day. And then apparently he got a little pushback and he altered it. And, you know, one thing that you see emerging this morning is a discussion of getting Bolton's book to the Senate so that they can look at it. And that would allow them, I think, to say, look, we saw the book. We all read the book. Or even they could allow, you know, some introduction of some evidence from it in a closed setting. If Lindsey Graham said it should be classified setting, which the book is not classified, it's going to be published, but in ways that it would still remain secret, but they would see it. But that would allow them to say, look, we read what Bolton had to say and we considered it, and we're going to vote no on opening this whole thing up to witnesses. And this is sort of the genius of Margaret has described this original vote. It's not a vote no on Bolton. It's a vote on, you know, streamlining and not having a ton of witnesses and prolonging it so the senators can say, look, we understood what Bolton could say and had to say. We saw the book, but we voted no to sort of open up this entire trial. And they may frame it that way as opposed to, you know, we voted no on Bolton.
All right, Quinta. So there's another actor in here, which is the White House. and the White House's interests are largely congruent with those of Mitch McConnell, but not entirely, in that the White House does not have to keep an unruly Senate caucus together, and it does have the constraints of the individual and his personality. So what's the White House's game plan here?
Ben, that was a very tactful way of saying that Trump has no strategy ever. I think that maybe I'm putting words in your mouth, but I do think that the conflict here is that Mitch McConnell is coldly practical, and the president just kind of does whatever he wants. And often those two things mean that they're at cross purposes. For example, there was a long period where it seemed like McConnell was really pushing not to have witnesses. And there were all these reports that the president wanted to have all the witnesses come in to exonerate him, you know, and talk about how great his perfect phone call was. So I do think that there is a risk here, the longer this draws out, that Trump will throw some kind of spoke in the wheels of whatever it is McConnell will have going on. And then the question will be, to what extent can McConnell manage that, and to what extent does it really throw him off course? To be fair, I think McConnell has kept a pretty tight hold on the White House so far, or McConnell working together with Trump's impeachment team. The president has definitely made statements that are against his own interests in the midst of the trial, which the House managers have played up. But I think those fall into the category of sort of embarrassing, but not, you know, derailing the entire thing.
So we've managed to get through this whole conversation without talking about Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz. So listeners can consider themselves lucky, and for whom those names are triggering, you can stop now before we get too far into it. But I do think that both of them made genuinely astonishing presentations yesterday in quite different ways. And I just wanted to get your all's sense of particularly how we should understand those two people making the arguments that they did without, go into the arguments to the extent that you want. But Jonathan, what did you make of it?
I mean, I think it was what the president seemed to want to hear from them in some role. And so they got up and said kind of what they were willing to say. And, you know, some of it was bizarre. It had nothing to do with kind of what was happening. And it was particularly bizarre to hear, you know, Ken Starr sort of start in about the age of impeachment and how, you know, this in the Independent Counsel Act, and start about his time in the Department of Justice and how the Department of Justice considered it unconstitutional when, you know, of course, he was the Independent Counsel later and in many ways sort of initiated a new age of impeachment. But I think they were, you know, they're famous. They have name recognition. Alan Dershowitz gave a very sort of lawyerly presentation, even if, you know, what he was saying is refuted by almost every sort of constitutional scholar out there. They gave the senators, I think, a sense of calm, I guess, that wanted to hear it. It didn't really matter what they said. They were saying something, and it was saying something in support of the president, and that's what the president wanted, and I think that's what the Republicans wanted, to say, look, here's a famous person who's got, you know, a lot of degrees and went to Harvard, and they said this is all fine, so I'm just going to follow them and kind of take away their agency.
Quinta, do you think that either Ken Starr or Alan Dershowitz would want on their tombstones that it was said about them after a major argument that they'd made that it, quote, didn't really matter what they said, unquote, to drop Jonathan's words in your lap?
Well, I can't speak to Ken Starr, but I think for Alan Dershowitz, I'm comfortable saying that the most important thing for Alan Dershowitz is that Alan Dershowitz was on television, and it really doesn't matter what he said, because by God, he stood there and he talked for an hour. And that he had, you know, as Jonathan said, the trappings of authority, right? He stood there and he talked about how he was, you know, Harvard Law Professor Emeritus, and he'd gone back and read all these dusty books, you know, and let me take you back to the time of the founding and the dusty streets of Philadelphia. And so it sounded like he knew what he was talking about, even though he could have been, you know, speaking gibberish or saying lorem ipsum over and over. And that is what matters at the end of the day.
Margaret, do you think it is fair to say that whenever a law professor stands up in front of Congress and announces how nonpartisan they are, that they are being partisan?
It's not a good look. It's just not a good look, and no one should do it. On a more serious note, you know, I do worry about what kind of a legacy those speeches, in particular Dershowitz's, you know, has for this trial, because I think, you know, we can all sit here and agree that the outcome of this is almost certainly going to be acquittal. And when history books are written, what will they say? Will they say that, you know, Alan Dershowitz got up and presented a novel theory about how there must be a crime charged as an article of impeachment for it to be valid? Will that be the reason that, you know, the history books say that the President Trump was acquitted? And what does that mean going forward? What does that mean for impeachments going forward? That's kind of what I think about is, you know, how does those speeches play in the history as part of the sort of canon, small canon of presidential impeachments?
We're going to leave it there. Margaret, Quinta, Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us. The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Hey, folks, we need your help to get more viral traction on the Lawfare podcast. We're reaching a surprising number of people now, but we could do better. If each of you who finds this episode valuable tweets about it, shares it on Facebook, posts it, a picture of yourself listening to it on Instagram, and of course, up our Pinterest game. You need to review and rate the Lawfare podcast on whatever podcast distribution service you use. You need to buy Lawfare merch at thelawfarestore.com. We've got pens, we've got diaries, we've got shirts, we've got all kinds of stuff. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this week is Jacob Schultz. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan, as always. And thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.